Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm glad you're with us tonight. And as we tell you, each time that we get together, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, you can. Here's our number from Oahu. It's 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else. Now, in the United States and countries around the world, access to fresh water is an ever-growing concern. Hawaii's limited area from which to draw water, plus our geographic isolation, makes it especially critical that we responsibly steward our water resources. Major water rights cases have peppered the news over decades. This legislative session, much of the focus has been on a contentious water rights bill that has undergone five revisions and is scheduled for a vote tonight. But in the form agreed to by conferees, does it really clarify longstanding claims to a public trust as much as it just provides a three-year window to resolve renewal applications without a break in the delivery of water? One thing is for certain, the issue of who gets water isn't going away. Today, my guests are going to take a big-picture look at Hawaii's available water for urban, agricultural, and cultural use. Here's our panel. William Tam has been a water and natural resources lawyer in Hawaii for 40 years. He's a former deputy director of the State Commission on Water Resources Management and deputy attorney general for DLNR and the State Water Commission. Tom Jambaluka is a professor of geography at UH Manoa. He specializes in climatology and hydrology of tropical environments. He and his team have produced web-accessible digital map products, including the Rainfall Atlas of Hawaii, Climate of Hawaii, and Solar Radiation of Hawaii. Ann Kapua Sproat joins us by phone. She is an associate professor at the William S. Richardson School of Law. She also provides overall program support for Kahuli Au Center for Excellence in Native Hawaiian Law and the Environmental Law Program, and she is the director of the Environmental Law Clinic. And, of course, you're here, too. And again, if you would like to join us tonight, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And thank you all for making time to be with us tonight. Professor Jambaluka, I want to start with you. Just to get a sense of where our water is and what's been happening with it. We've heard some predictions over the last several years about how rainfall has been changing, that the patterns of rain will be elsewhere than what we've experienced in past, and that in some cases that's going to mean that where we have traditionally watched rain go to be able to water crops isn't going to happen or happen as frequently.
Yes, that's right. We have seen some pretty big changes in rainfall over long periods of time, over as much as 100 years. We can see steady decreases. But we have seen really sharp decreases in the past several decades. So it's a significant amount. It's enough that it's changed our stream flow, the amount of water flowing in streams, especially the base flow, which is the amount of water that flows when it's not raining, and which is a good indication of the state of the groundwater.
Island to island, how would you project what we should be looking at over the next little while?
Well, we can first look at what's already happened, we can see that a lot of the decreases have been focused in certain areas. For example, the western part of the Big Island has experienced the biggest and most consistent decreases in rainfall going back 100 years and continuing up to today. We're also seeing decreases in the eastern part of Maui on Haleakala, the windward slopes of Haleakala and other areas of the state. But really the biggest decreases have been on the western part of the Big Island, the Kona area.
As you look at some of the water issues that we've seen over time and the idea of, you know, who gets what water rightfully, that also depends on where the water really is. The rainfall may be changing. What other changes do you see that will impact how we tend to look at our state, particularly as we're talking about diversified agriculture and what our needs will be as our state continues to grow in its population?
Well, one of the things that we would like to know is how rainfall is going to change in the future, and your earlier question was along those lines. And that kind of gets to this issue of changing patterns, not only changing amounts. And although it's, you know, our projections for changes in the future are still quite uncertain, one of the patterns that emerges is that it's going to be drier in the drier parts of the state. It's going to become even drier in all those areas where we use water, where almost all of us live, where most of the agriculture is and the irrigation, where the resorts and hotels and golf courses are. So if that turns out to be true, that is going to that foretells big increases in the needs for water, big increases in demand. As rainfall decreases in those areas, more water is going to be needed for irrigation.
Which also seems to suggest, William Tam, that we're going to be talking about higher water costs.
Water right now is greatly underpriced. It's not that you're paying for water, you're paying for the delivery of it. But when it's not expensive to get it, then there's a tendency not to conserve. So one of the most important things we can start to do is actually engage in conservation. Across the world, one of the ways to do that is increasing the per unit cost of water. So that is something that can be done. It's very clear that conservation is the cheapest available next water to save because you don't have to move it. You don't have to use the electricity to move it. So pricing water at a better rate is very important for overall conservation.
Conservation is, you know, part of the overall plan for, you know, how we are going to be able to approach water in future, looking at water as being not so much just a commodity, as some have looked at it in the past, but also part of the public trust. And in putting those two things together with an accelerating population and also the need to feed ourselves better, it seems as if a lot of these things have been looked at very singularly and not necessarily putting them all together in an integrated fashion.
That's right. I mean, that is a really important point that people tend to forget. We need to start looking horizontally about how water, energy, and food, for example, all connect. Simple example. It costs a fair amount of money, electricity, to pump water. Now, if you have gravity fed off of streams, that's fine, but if that's increasingly going to be declining, then we're talking about moving groundwater. And when you do that, you've got to pump it and then push it out. The electrical costs, which are more price elastic depending on demand, could be a way in which we start to be more cautious about our use of water just because if the cost of moving it's more expensive, people will think about it before they do that. One of the things we tend to forget about is what happens on the land. As you change the land use patterns, you change the water supply. I mean, Tom talked about rainfall, but for example, in central Oahu in the last 40 years, the groundwater that's recharged by normal furrow irrigation of sugar, that groundwater started to decline from overpumping. Then the plantation company switched to drip irrigation, which is much more efficient, but it doesn't recharge the ground as much. Well, now we've got urban housing, and so the water doesn't even sink in the ground. It actually runs off of hard surfaces. So water is not a fixed amount that comes down in any given place. It is constantly an adjustment to the circumstances of the surface and how it permeates the ground.
Kapuas Broad, I want to get you into this conversation too. As you hear all of us trying to grapple with what do we do about getting water with an accelerating population, with lots of needs that we say that we're going to need to claim water for, be it for diversified agriculture, for people, whatever. How do you look at that in terms of who has what water rightfully?
Well, in Hawaii, we're incredibly fortunate because we have a very progressive framework for water resource management. Under our Constitution and under our state water code as well, our water resources are a public trust, which means that they belong to all of us. And that the state, currently the Commission on Water Resource Management, has a kuleana to manage these resources for present and future generations. So the people who put our current regulatory framework into place, starting with the 1978 constitutional amendment and then the 1987 water code, were great in the sense that they built this very progressive framework that includes adaptive management and really gives the commission not only very clear mandate with respect to protection and restoration, but also an adaptive framework to be able to move us forward given all of these competing demands. So we're very fortunate to have this in place. We've been dealing with this transition from industrial ag to a more diversified and sustainable system since the closure of the plantations. And really the Waihole case that was decided by the Hawaii Supreme Court in 2000 created a clear framework that makes clear that there are only a handful of public trust purposes, including traditional and customary Native Hawaiian practices and environmental protection, and that other uses, such as private commercial interests, are a second tier to that important level of protection.
So with that protection in place, though, do you actually see that happening? Because clearly we have case after case that we've had to wrestle with.
You know, although we have great laws on the books, and the black letter law is very clear with respect to what the priorities should be, and indeed, in my opinion, what the directives are to our managers, like the Water Commission, like the Board of Land and Natural Resources, what I've seen in my almost 20 years of experience working on these issues is that the agencies that are charged with enforcing these mandates have lacked the political will to do what the law requires. And so this isn't the case of us not being clear on what the law requires. It's a case of the administrators and the decision makers not being willing, not having the political wherewithal to do it. Oftentimes because many of the players, like plantation interests or former plantation interests, have tremendous political clout. Of course, these agencies also haven't been given sufficient funding to do the science and other work. But to me, the rub has really been the politics of water in Hawaii.
William Tam, that sort of speaks directly to what used to do not that long ago. How do you assess the idea that political will is not sufficient for us to be able to do what Kapua Sproat says the letter of the law says we should do?
I think Kapua's right. You need to look at a couple of things. One, the Department of Land and Natural Resources manages almost half of the geographic land and water space in the state. All the streams, all the forests, all the enforcement, conservation, fishing, forestry, and yet there is a total of about 1% of the total state budget. You would have to at least triple that budget to have a fair shot at even doing the job. So it has been grossly understaffed and underfunded, and it's been a problem as long as I've been there. The second point is the laws are good, and in many cases the laws are slow to be enforced, partly because we've been going through an evolution in Hawaii water law. Remember that in the 1970s, the view was that people owned water. It took a fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to change that. When we adopted the Water Code in 87, it took a long time to put the pieces in place to do that, and probably it took the Waiholi case finally for the court to say, okay, this is serious, we're now going to do that. During that transition, there were a lot of old habits that did not change easily. And what we're witnessing now is sort of a final resolution that the old perception that you can own and control water at your will is finally being overturned. But it takes each court case. And I will say that there has been a habit in this state of people with political power, institutions, in effect, finding themselves with having a seat on many of these boards and, if you will, slowing down that process. There's been a rear guard action against actually carrying this out, and that it's very difficult for people with limited resources to overcome some of that. So Kapua is right in that regard. It's been a slow slog, but there have been people with great vision and great courage, and I point out Bill Patey, for example, who had been a manager of a plantation but was chair of the board that helped get the Water Commission created. His vision was incredibly important in establishing the leadership that happened. And there's been that constant tug of both ways, but you have to keep pushing toward that.
To sort of read between the lines from what you've said and what Kapua said a little while ago, it seems as if we don't get action unless there is litigation.
Well, you need to understand that one of the things the Water Code does, and people don't appreciate this, it is not simply a black letter rule. It is the place, and when we had this view when we wrote the code back in 87, that it is a place where all these different forces of the future come together. And one of the things that I was particularly concerned at when I was at the Attorney General's office and then the Water Commission was that it takes a long time to bring all these different pieces together. There is, for example, in the code, a water use and development plan provision that every county prepares their own plans, combined with an ag plan, combined with the health department, combined with public infrastructure. That mechanism is a place where you bring together all these different things we're talking about. And It's very slow to integrate all those, but it's a process by getting people together in a way that is often only precipitated, frankly, by a crisis.
All right. Well, we don't have exactly a crisis tonight, but we are a place where we can all get together to talk about water. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open at 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, use that number, 941-3689. Or from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, you can call us at 877-941-3689. We're talking about the future of Hawaii's water and what are we going to do to make sure that we have enough. Going now to Charlie calling us from Waihole.
Hello.
Hi there, Charlie. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, you guys.
Hi, Charlie.
I just wanted to say there was an interesting moment in the Waihole water case. It was, you know, which basically didn't get noticed very much, but the Department of Business and Economic Development was on the stand, and they were asked the question, how do you do population growth projections? And everybody was thinking, oh, well, birth, you know, death rate. But what they said was, is that population growth rates are done at least in part by looking at our main economic drivers, construction and tourism, and what kind of growth they need to be healthy. And that's partly how we do population growth projections. And NPR is no different from any other news organization. Whenever new housing starts go up, that's reported as positive news. And whenever tourism, as was reported this morning, when there are more tourists coming here, that's always reported as positive. But if you know anything about steady state economics, there's no such thing as perpetual growth. So what does our economy look like if we don't have that kind of perpetual growth? And, you know, just one more comment, then I'll go off. A and B, everybody has to remember, is basically a real estate agency. And these large landowners, they're not really interested in agriculture. They want to keep that land in agriculture, keep their tax rates down. And when the time comes to develop, they're on it because they make way more money from developing than they ever will make from agriculture.
Which seems to be, you know, part of the discussion that has been surrounding some of the Dole lands that are up for sale and what's going to be done with those and why the state may be considering purchasing them. Thank you, Charlie, very much for your call. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are available at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. All the claims on the water, all the things that we need, and certainly Charlie brought up some of the issues concerning visitors and what we need to provide for tourists and what we need to provide for ourselves. But it sounds in many ways as if we don't look at this as being an integrated system, that we talk about what's rainfall going to bring to us or what can we do about being able to divert streams. Is there a better integrated way of looking at this that you think that we should be that we're not yet?
Actually, the Water Code provides for that. I mean, that's what the Water Use and Development Plan does. It's been 25 years in the making, but the tools are all there. It's a matter of the leadership taking it and saying, we're going to integrate this now. I mean, one thing you mentioned is, how do you get people to think further ahead? Because all the economic incentives are for short-term responses. We tend to think that in quarters or maybe even years, but the kind of thing we need to think about is 20 to 30 years out. Water resources are like a very large infrastructure shift that we're going to have to go through, and you can't turn hard 90-degree corners on this. You've got to imagine in 20 to 30 years, what is the situation going to be, and we have to start anticipating that change. You know, in the prior centuries or prior decades, life was slower, and therefore you could make those turns. The pressures on us today to make short-term decisions, I think, is really going to be fatal. If we don't start thinking in terms of our grandchildren, not as a parent but as a grandparent, then we're going to have too short a time frame in which we make infrastructure decisions. If you think about what Tom's working on, he's looking at long-term weather patterns that you know are coming. I mean, it's almost like you can see it on the horizon. And when I hear him talk about the change in rainfall patterns, people don't – I mean, you almost need to get him to explain what is that really going to look like. I mean, he said it, but – what's life going to be like when it's hotter, when the weather patterns are more erratic, when you have climate changes that are going to be much more daunting than what we've experienced in the last few years? What's that mean to our life here?
Well, that's the question that you say that we're not really stopping to consider, but we will now. As you look at life in 20, 30, 40 years, do you think that that picture is one that has been communicated well to the public and that people are really thinking about that, or that because of our nature in thinking so short term that it's just not a place we want to go?
I think we all suffer from kind of short vision, but some people get it, and a lot of people really don't want to think about it. They don't want to think about how things are going to change in the future. But we are going to see some pretty big changes that are going to affect water. And I mentioned the changes in rainfall, and that's certainly a big part of it. But as Bill said, it's going to be hotter, and that's going to also affect us in ways related to water. It's going to mean we're going to need more water. And in places where rainfall decreases, it's also going to be sunnier, which means we're going to need more water. So I think all these changes portend a less comfortable environment, and one in which we're more reliant on our water resources, and we're going to need the caller Charlie brought up the point of growing population, and that's also going to add to our demand for water.
To say nothing of our complete reliance in many ways on tourism.
Absolutely. So if you take the resident population and our visitor population together, and if we project that they'll continue to grow, at the same time these changes in climate that we think may happen actually do, we're really going to be facing some crises unless we start addressing the problems now with infrastructure changes and conservation and so forth.
We've got a lot of callers waiting to get in on this conversation, but before we go to them, Kapoor Sprott, I just want to ask you, as you're listening to these projections, and certainly you've seen them and you know them, and when we hear from Tom Jambalucha that it's going to be a much less comfortable life that we will be potentially living in 20, 30, 40 years, how do you approach the issue of water and water going to people rightfully?
You know, for years now, we've had the luxury of tremendous water resources in Hawaii, and we've taken those resources for granted. And as Tom just explained very well, you know, climate change is real. It's already happening. And we don't even fully understand the extent to which these changes will take place. I think that what that underscores is the importance of doing what the law already requires with the Water Code, with our Constitution, the importance of upholding the public trust and really managing our resources, as opposed to commodities. We no longer have the luxury of being able to move hundreds of millions of gallons from one side of the other to from one side of the island to the other without regard for what the consequences are on groundwater recharge, on many of these systems. Having water flowing in streams from Mauka to Makai is critical to recharge our underground aquifers, which provide the primary source of drinking water for Hawaii's most populated communities. And so these issues affect everyone. We are incredibly lucky that we have this framework in place with the law. What we need is for our decision makers to respect the public trust, to uphold it, to take seriously their duties as fiduciaries and their kulana to manage for the greater good, not for special interest.
All right, we're going to get to all of our callers. If you'd like to join the conversation, do it sooner rather than later, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Dennis calling us from Maui. Aloha, Dennis. Welcome to
Aloha.
Town Square.
I just have two things to say. One, to get the water back, first of all, we need to have an environmental impact study of all development. Or how Maui is to be planned, is to have consideration for the wind, because the wind is what changes the microclimate and what changes what the soil and also the current in the ocean. The other thing is that land that HCNS is now not going to use, the 35,000 acres or so. If you look at the map of Maui, the map that shows the weather, the green belt goes from Hana to West Maui. And included in that is the 35,000 acres or so of sugarcane. Now, that used to be the dry land forest. Without that, we've cut the two forests in half. And the East Maui and West Maui Mountains, that isthmus is also a vortex where the wind comes through. So without any wind abatement, which the forest would provide, which they took away when they did the cane field, East Maui and West Maui won't have any more water. Now, keeping bees, I found out, seems like within 5 years, with that cane all gone and the wind coming through, everything else will die. And if you look at the coloration of the West Maui forest in relation to the East Maui forest, the East Maui forest is always showing a color of yellow. And so is the land that goes from Makawao across Kula to Ulupalapua is a yellow strip. And that's what's happening. We are losing the West and the East Maui and Kula. And West Maui right now is not probably producing enough water. So we can talk about the development of our tourism. If the tourists want to come, fine. Bring their money, but also bring the water. Because we cannot afford it.
All right.
We need to have wind abatement.
Well, I heard you, Dennis. We've got a lot of callers on the line now. I think we've got your point. Thank you so much for your call. So, you know, he's talking about the fact that, you know, he believes that the lands have cut the forest in half. Do you see evidence of what he says that the wind is caused, that the wind abatement needs to happen?
Well, I think his point that land cover affects the local wind and wind speeds is absolutely true. I don't know of any changes that have been observed that have resulted from, you know, land cover changes that have happened recently. I do think there are going to be microclimate changes as a result of the demise of the plantation, but it depends a lot on what happens to
what happens
land.
Next, though, right? I mean, because what we don't really know what that land is going to turn into and what may be farmed there.
Exactly. So if there's no irrigation, then there'll be there'll be big changes because of that, and there are good reasons why we might not have irrigation there in the future, at least not at the same levels, because of exactly the things that we've been talking about here about the use of water and what should happen to that water. But if there is no longer irrigation there, it will be warmer in that isthmus area, in the Pu'unaina area of Maui, and downwind of that.
But still, going back to how, not whether there'll be water there or not, but maybe how much less might be used given what might be grown there. I mean, those are all things that we just don't know yet.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. We're going to go take a few more callers. You want to jump in here?
I just point out that diversified ag takes a lot less water than sugar does. I mean, furrow irrigation for sugar was 11,000 gallons an acre a day. Drip irrigation is closer to 6 or 7. Diversified ag can be between 2,500 and 3,500 gallons an acre a day. So the water requirements alter a lot depending on what you're growing.
All right. I'm going to go take a few more callers. Larry calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Larry, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. So I'm calling from the Kona side of the Big Island, which is without open water and depends entirely on, wells, water wells. And I want to open the discussion about how the state manages that resource. It's basically definitely tilted toward the rich and influential in terms of developing new wells for their residences and how we might be able to handle that situation. As the one percenters move here and develop their type of housing, they are drilling wells without any public use of the resource. And I'm wondering how we can address that.
All right. Thank you, Larry, for the question. We'll go to William Tam for that answer.
Sure. The way the water code is set up right now is that in a designated water management area, you have to get a permit before you can put a well in the ground. In areas that are not yet designated for management, and that includes, for the moment, the west side of the Big Island, all you is required is a well construction permit and a pump installation permit, and that's sort of a minimalist permitting process that's mostly ministerial based upon engineering standards. The issue about anticipating water demand is going to be taken care of, or can be taken care of legally, in the Water Use and Development Plan, which is where you have to add up all your current uses and all your projected uses to see if you're going to reach that 90% level or if their areas are threatened specifically. And it is the place where water could be reserved for future uses. One of the really dangers that you pointed out earlier that does not get enough attention, Hawaii is not a first-come, first-served basis. The Western United States, it's called a prior appropriation model, is based on mining law that said first in line, first in time, first in right. Hawaii does not have that view, either for groundwater or for surface water. It is what is called for surface water, a riparian state, which everybody along a stream gets to share in the use of that stream, or in the case of groundwater, what's called correlative rights, which is everybody overlying an aquifer has the right to some use of that water. In California, if you're the last person in, you're the first person out, and you lose everything. In Hawaii, everyone has some right to use water, so it's going to be a constant adjustment. And the real question is going to be, as the caller just pointed out, what happens to public infrastructure needs? What happens to a school? If they're coming along in 20 years and you've not reserved enough water for that school or that hospital, are they going to be left out? Legally, the answer is no, but the real question is going to be the cheap water that's near, that doesn't require going down deep or long pipelines, is going to get allocated first. So the real issue, at least in the near future, is going to be how do you reserve water in places you know you have public needs coming? Now, Hawaiian Homes has a special provision based upon the 1921 Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, and they've been rather slowly getting their act together to start to look at what their future needs are. But if we don't reserve those water locations now, then in the future we're going to find ourselves in a difficult situation.
Kapoor Spro, we're not necessarily great about that kind of long-term vision.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, Bill raised a very important point with respect to designation. Designation is, I think, a critical aspect of this. Currently, only the island of Oahu, the island of Molokai, and the Iao Aquifer on Maui are designated for groundwater management, and only the Navai'eha area is designated for surface water management. The rest of Hawaii has not yet been designated, and that also has been a political issue because many counties have been, or, you know, other interests have been resistant to designation because of the additional permitting that Bill described. And so what my understanding is that when the water code was passed, it was always the plan that all of Hawaii would eventually be designated, and that process was just phasing in more appropriate management, but for political and other reasons, that never occurred. So for Larry from Kona and for other people, you know, on Kauai or in other areas that aren't yet designated, that is one potential solution to address the reservation issue and other issues. Now, designation is a blunt instrument. It's not perfect, and the permitting requirements have administrative and other burdens, but that's certainly one tool that's currently available in the water code to help address these issues.
If you're just joining us now, that was just Kapoor Sproat speaking to us by phone. She's an associate professor at the William S. Richardson School of Law. She also provides overall program support for Kahului'au Center for Excellence in Native Hawaiian Law and Environmental Law. Tonight we're talking about water. My guests here in the studio include Tom Jemaluka. He is professor of geography at UH Manoa, specializing in climatology and hydrology of tropical environments, and William Tam, who has been a water and natural resources lawyer in Hawaii for 40 years. He's also the former deputy director of the State Commission on Water Resources Management, Deputy Attorney General for DLNR and the State Water Commission. And, of course, you're here, too. And if you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands. We're going to go now to Janet, who has called us from Maui and has been waiting patiently. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. I wanted to say that, you know, everyone loves to hate the big corporations like AMB, but I think we have to look at practical reality. We have 27,000 acres of central Maui that has been designated in IAL, meaning that it's going to stay in agriculture. And I don't think that fact is being given to the public, that it isn't, like one of the last callers said, this land is going to be abandoned. It's going to be, you know, stopped from sugarcane growing and left. No, that's not the plan at all. We all want diversified crops. We all want to be more self-sustaining and reliable, you know, to have our food grown here. But in order to do that, we have to have water to grow it. I mean, nobody in their right mind can look at the central isthmus and think that that land, that desert, is going to be able to support diversified crops. And to me, you know, when we talk about the public trust mandates that water continues to flow to central Maui to support that 36,000 acres. I think we have to be realistic about that. if we truly want diversified ag. You know, I don't think anyone should be talking about putting all of the water back in the streams. Why are we doing that? Why are we saying 100% in either direction, A and B or East Maui? No, the water has to be split fairly, but it can't all be put back in the streams to support, you know, limited taro growth and then out to the ocean. So I just don't understand why we're so divisive in this conversation. And I don't know also why we have to keep looking back to the past and doing the blame game. We're in the present. Let's look towards the future and resolve this for everyone amicably.
I think that's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much, Janet, for your call, and thank you for waiting patiently so we could get you on. She brings up a number of points. You know, how do you divide this fairly? If you're going to have diversified ag and you're going to have it there in central Maui, you've got to be able to have water flowing there too, especially if we hear that, you know, A and B is going to be maybe leasing some of this land, perhaps leasing some of it for cattle grazing. We don't know yet what may be happening. We talked about that a little bit earlier, but that it's got to have water too.
Well, I think you have to go back and look at how the law is structured. We spent 20 or 30 years getting this straight, and we did a pretty good job, I think. So it's not just an abstract proposition that's going to be this way or that way. There's basically, if you want to think of it as an inverted pyramid in terms of decision making, there are certain things you have to do legally. There are certain things you have to do factually. There are certain things you have to do with regard to minimum in-stream flows. You've got to show what the uses are off the stream. So if you think of this as a decision making process in which you do a series of cuts and you think about, okay, what do you have to do to make sure the stream stays alive? What do you have to do to make sure that those who have water rights as a matter of law are protected? And then you have to look at a basic proposition in water law throughout the world, in fact, is the concept that no one has a right to waste water. And that can be taken either negatively, you can't just throw it away, or it can be taken positively to say you have an affirmative duty to be conservative and efficient. In the water code, there is a provision that defines reasonable beneficial use, and it's a concept used throughout the world. And that says that you have to use the water in a way that's both economic and efficient. Those are not the same thing. For example, growing watercress in the desert is not, it may be economic, but it's not an efficient use of water. So that I think this is where we can really start to figure out how to accommodate all these uses by looking at these series of requirements. Simple example. I'll keep this short, but every place, based on the work that Tom has done and others, has a different amount of water you need to use for that parcel of land, whether it's taro or some other crop. It's based on soil types. It's based on how warm it is there. It's based on slope. And so you choose the amount of water appropriate to that place and that crop. That can be done, but it needs to be done in a structured context, not just I like this or I don't like this.
All right, we're going to take a few more.
This is Kapoor. I just wanted to address something really quickly.
Please do.
Janet had mentioned that she said the public trust mandates water for diversified ag continue to flow to central Maui, and that's actually not accurate. Under the public trust, the Hawaii Supreme Court has identified a handful of public trust purposes. Those include environmental protection, Native Hawaiian traditional and customary rights and practices, domestic water uses, which are individual household needs, not municipal needs, and the water reservations for the Department of Hawaiian Homeland. So those all have priority. Agriculture, including diversified ag, is a public purpose, not a public trust purpose. So they are second tier to the public trust protection. And I think she's absolutely right. You know, we need to be looking forward and not doing the blame game. But in doing that, in recognizing that if diversified ag is going to continue, the water needs are significantly less than sugar, as Bill already mentioned. So a significant amount of water would be available even if that entire is in the state and diversified ag. But I think the important point to consider is, as Bill has pointed out, is that the law makes clear that before you can take water, there are certain requirements, including looking at the needs of the streams and looking at the people with priority rights, like Native Hawaiians and appurtenant water users. And that was never done in East Maui or in many other places throughout Hawaii. So, you know, in going forward, in looking at this historic moment that we have the opportunity to do things right. And that's what should happen.
All right. Thank you very much for the clarification. We're going to move on to some of our callers. And if you'd like to join us, get on the phone and call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight, we're talking about the future of Hawaii's water. Going now to Matt, calling us from Lana'i. Aloha, Matt. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, aloha. Thank you for this discussion. Lana'i is unique, and that's one of the things I'd like to have you discuss, is that each island is unique in its water resources. So it's not like electricity. You're going to run cables between the islands and have net metering and shift water back and forth between the islands. So each of the islands has a unique need for water and a unique set of water supplies. And we've got a water and use and development plan that lays that all out. Secondly, desalinization. Lana'i, Mr. Ellison has come up with a possible project here, didn't like the permit. Whether you're taking the water out of the ocean or drilling wells on the land and tapping, you know, into some kind of a salinated water source, to me it's the issue of supply and demand. You're talking about a finite supply of water if you're just dealing with nature. If you can't produce more water, then you're stuck with court battles from now until forever as to who gets the right to use water and for what purposes. And the landowners have a lot to say about that. It's individual land. Here, this is a private water system. The water pumping system on Maui is a public water system. So I'd like you guys to discuss, and the last one is pricing, and I agree with pricing is the key. Public Utility Commissions comes into rate setting. I respect quorum, and I respect the legal system, but somehow, if you want development 50 years from now, or you don't want development, it's a if you can find more water, which I don't think you can, without doing something drastic. So kick it around. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Matt, for your call. He brought up a number of things to do. First of all, the idea, let's talk about this one for a moment, of more water. And we've had some discussions in the past about desalination, some smaller pilot projects, but nothing, anything that's really brought us any real hope or future that there's going to be fresh water that we'd be able to produce from desalination plants. Is it really possible for us to be able to find a way to produce more water, given what you've just said about what we may expect from rainfall, given the fact that it's going to be tremendously expensive to try to pump deeper into being able to bring up groundwater? Is there anything else that we're missing in this conversation that we should be looking at to connect dots better, or maybe pools of water?
There is developable groundwater in some parts of the state, but one of the points the caller made was, you know, we need to have the water where the needs are, and that they don't always coincide. So we have a limited ability to develop water where it's needed. Desalination is, you know, is an ultimate backstop, and it's being done in various places around the world. I don't advocate it, and it flies in the face of other goals of the state, which, for example, energy, a move to alternative energy and energy independence. Desalination is highly energy intensive, and expensive, and so in that way, it's very puts big limits on our ability to use that as a solution.
I think one of the things we have not looked at seriously, but Israel does it, Australia does it, South Africa does it, it's done in California, and that is reusing wastewater. Now, it's usually the UGG factor. People don't like it, but a lot of the initial use of reused wastewater can be for irrigation. You can do drinking water. South Africa does it. It's all chemistry. So we got to get over the psychological concept. But for irrigation,
the U factor.
It is the UGG factor, right. But, for example, on Oahu, the Board of Water Supply pumps on the order of 145, 146 million gallons a day now. Of that, about 100 million of that goes out in the ocean. So two-thirds of the fresh groundwater we pump for domestic purposes ends up in the ocean, which, by the way, invariably violates the Clean Water Act, which puts pressure on the environmental services of every county because they've got to process it. We right now have essentially Honolulu Sand Island and some out in Hawaii Kai, Sand Island, or Sandy Beach area, wastewater treatment facilities that are centralized. And we built a big infrastructure to do that. And that was the result of the notion that you needed bigger facilities to handle more and it's more economic. We may need to start looking at decentralized, smaller wastewater treatment facilities that you can treat to an R1 level. Right now, the Army is doing that at Schofield Barracks. They've got a small facility on a contract with Aqua Engineers for a 65-year contract to take the wastewater off of Schofield, treat it, and then turn it back under irrigation.
So how small is small?
Well, right now they're pumping between 2 to 5 million gallons a day, but you can scale it up. You can do something, it's not a great choice of phrases, but they call scalping plants. And it's literally, you could, for example, take a half a Matson container, put it by a site for a wastewater pipe, and within about 2 to 3 days, take the water out, run it through a screen process. The heavier solids you then can still move on to your larger facility. But if you did it on site, that would then become ag irrigation water. There's probably 20 million gallons of ag demand along Cunha Road. You could provide that with R1 water from Central Wahoo.
I hear you say that we could make many closed systems that would be serving specific areas.
Yes, and it would be resilient to climate change in the sense that you move off the shoreline. You're going to have to move the wastewater plants off the shoreline at some point. So start thinking about that retreat. Start building in your energy, water, and ag as a unified system instead of standalone silos.
All right. Well, right now
quickly, just a point on desal. I think Bill's right. We need to, there are things that we can look at with planning. But I also think we can't just look forward and, you know, what's happened in the past remains in the past. For us, we're not there yet with respect to desal. We have tremendous resources. It's a matter of management and it's a matter of distribution and reallocation. On many of the islands, we have these plantation interests, and if we just take, you know, Andy or East Mine, for example, that are using a tremendous amount of the water resources in East Maui, you know, 160 to 200 million gallons per day comes out of East Maui and that A&B takes, that's more than the entire island of Oahu. And, you know, these ditch systems were built in the 1800s or 1900s. They're old and leaky. And in 2016, we have the technological capacity and the moral responsibility to do more with less. So, yes, from a planning perspective, we need to look at closed systems and plan better for development. But it just the onus can't just rest there. We also need to look at who's holding the water now and how those resources need to be distributed based on the law, not policy.
All right. We're going to move on in the interest of time because we've got callers who want to talk to all of you. Going now to Ron, calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Ron. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Great program. We've got to protect our water. Not only can we assume that the water that's coming out of the ground is pure and drinkable water, because of the injection wells that we have, Kauai, we have 90 of them over here. An injection well is where we pump waste into the ground, deep into the aquifers, with the concept that it won't leach out into the other drinking water aquifers, which has recently been proved to be a fallacy, and that it is leaking into other water aquifers. Oahu's got 160 of them over there where they're pumping human waste, industrial waste, even radioactive waste into the ground over there. So the water coming out of the ground with this leaching, some of our soil, Kauai especially, is one of the most permeable land surfaces on Earth, and it's moving through the ground. That's why our streams around here, I believe, we have a lot of pollution showing up in our streams. So to go with the concept that if we find water, it's going to be usable for a drinking water may be erroneous as well because of the leaching into these aquifers from the injection wells. Nobody seems to want to talk about it, and it seems very very elusive. Nobody really knows what's going on until recently. The mainland is having a big problem with this as well, where from the fracking and everything is showing up in the drinking water around there.
All right. Well, let me see if I can get you an answer from Bill Tam about this. And you know, the idea that somehow, you know, we're in the injection wells, we're pumping human waste, he says, according to what he had to tell us a moment ago, radioactive waste, all that. Do you have any proof that any of that is actually happening?
I'm not aware of that. The health department has management over those issues. The reinjection wells are below what's called the UIC line, so they're not going into the aquifer. They're closer to the shore. Now, there is some problem that they could leach out into the ocean, and generally, the EPA and the health department have been trying to get away from those to a large extent. So it's a matter, like, for example, cesspools. They're trying to get rid of cesspools. That's probably what he's thinking about in terms of human waste. Those are being phased out, but in rural areas it's been difficult. So that's an ongoing issue. I know in Kauai, especially in the North Shore, there's been an effort to get rid of the cesspools near the ocean.
And of course, we had legislation again this year.
Yeah. The health department is the one that oversees the water quality issues, and that's integrated into the water use and development plans, but that's really their kuleana.
All right. We're going to take a few more callers. We have Mary calling us from Maui. Aloha, Mary. Thank you very much for your patience.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for having the show. And really important to see that, you know, A and B does have other options for water, for one thing. So that concerns me that they keep crying, you know, no water, no water. And yet the people in K&I and all the waterfalls in K&I can be dry, and we're supposed to be the number one island for tourism, but they want to see waterfalls. So, you know, why doesn't the legislature jump on helping the taro farmers when they don't have water? They only jump and make a bill when A and B doesn't have water. But aside from that, and I hear a lot of good ideas, I also think we should stop injection wells right away. And I'd like to ask you, how do we make the entire island chain now a water management zone? Because from what I'm reading, our water table levels have already dropped like 50% from Pearl Harbor. So, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and I'm sure I and my grandkids and great-grandkids and all ours would rather drink good, clean water than have this treated whatever water, and I sure don't want to put that on my crops. I'm a farmer, and I don't want to spread that on my land. I can tell you that, and you don't want to eat the food, I don't think, that comes out of the garden after that. You're just never going to get it back. And we love off rainwater now. We're on a stream, and I got to tell you how good it feels to not be taking water out of the ground from the water table. I live next to the national park, and they run their wells, and they run them for toilets now. Pure water, well water, is flushing the million tourist toilets in Kipahulu every year now. Anyway, I think that the taro farmers in East Maui, they've gone through all the courts, and they got to right. So why is the legislature trying to just set up a special bill for A and B? It is for A and B because they took them out and then they put them back in.
Right, we're not going to go into that bill fully right now. They're going to be looking at that bill in about half an hour's time, and we'll see what happens with the vote on that. But really, the bill is giving a 3-year window, more than perhaps giving, you know, a definitive answer about who has what water rightfully.
Actually, all it does is authorize the Board of Land Natural Resources to extend a revocable permit for 3 years while a lease process goes forward.
Right, so it's a window saying that nothing is going to really change within 3 years while that process is being looked at.
If you look at the language, all it does is authorize the board to consider it.
All right, we've got another Mary on the line, but I want to get you in on some of this too, just to answer her very briefly about the issue of freshwater and being, you know, she's saying that freshwater is being used in the toilets and others, and that we're really not husbanding that as well. And she's not exactly feeling, I guess, comfortable with the idea of creating a use for gray water.
I'm not aware that the National Park Service actually has been very good about changing systems and doing dual pipes and that sort of thing. And one of the issues that I think this raises is we tend to think in very short-term economic terms what we can do right now. We need to build systems that will eventually be good for the future, and that involves dual pipe systems, that involves recycling gray water, and a lot of these things, the point you made earlier, we need to think of them in a 20 or 30 year horizon instead of just what's economic in the next quarter. And if we do that, we'll start investing in the right approaches that will take care of some of these issues.
All right, we have another Mary on the line, also calling from Maui, not the same person. Aloha, other Mary from Maui.
Aloha.
Hi there.
Hi. Yes, just as a short-term temporary fix while the politics is taking its course, I thought it would be great to have whoever the powers may be encourage financial support, tax credits for water catchment for landowners who already own their land to be building their small homes on. And that is something that has never been brought up, and I know it's encouraged in many, many other states and other parts of the world. So That's my only comment, is to have financial support or tax credits for water catchment systems.
All right, Mary, thanks very much for the call. The whole issue of tax credits, on one hand, it seems to be an incentive. On the other hand, it can be the meat hook that you're swing on for a long time if you just realize that the tax credits run out.
This would just be for construction. And construction for catchment systems is dropping very quickly. There are people in the Big Island that do it very well. It does not have to be expensive and doesn't have to be $30,000.
So maybe it doesn't need tax credit?
There are people that are doing this at a very low cost. So I would do that and not wait for the tax credits. It will save you money eventually. What the payback time is depends on how much you're going to spend.
We're down to the last couple of minutes of the show, and I just wanted to talk to all three of you and just let you give a little bit of a vision here. As we talked about through the hour of different ideas of how we might begin to use our water more wisely to integrate it better, obviously you could hear some of the resistance in some of the calls. Your point all the way around, though, is that change is going to be coming whether we like it or not, and that we have to have some better vision as we look out into 20, 30, 40-year, 50-year horizons. Just to wrap this up a little bit, Professor Giambaluca, as you see and have heard some of what we've been talking about today, plus some of the things that we couldn't even get to in this last hour, is there a way that you think that we ought to be approaching this conversation and approaching our water use and that we haven't really done well and should be doing much, much better now?
Yeah, there is one really important change that needs to take place, and that is that we can no longer plan for the future based on our experiences in the past. We're in a new era now, and it has been a very useful construct, an engineering approach that has served us well for 100 years or more, that we could make plans, we could make our designs on bridges and water systems and so forth based on the record, on the history of what has happened in the last 100 years. That is a principle called stationarity. That is that things will remain as they have been in the past. They will vary within a certain range, and we can rely on that in the future, but we can't anymore. So we cannot plan the way we have always planned in the past, and I think that's an important thing that everybody needs to realize.
It almost sounds like that financial construct that past performance doesn't guarantee future returns. A word from you.
I think that is absolutely right. I think we have to start looking at water for where you at the end point. What do people need, and how do you help build from that? Don't build a system and then figure you're going to get the water to people.
And Kapoor, you've got about 30 seconds.
I'd just say my vision is to manage our water resources as a public trust for present and future generations, not short-term needs. And thank goodness we have the framework to do that. We just need our decision makers to have the political wherewithal to do what the law requires.
Kapoor Sproat, thank you so much for joining us by phone in our studio. Professor Tom Giambaluca and Bill Tam, thank you for being here. Look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you.
And to all of you who joined us tonight by phone, thank you for your calls. We'll see you again here next week as we take a look at how the ledge wraps up. In the meantime, I'll see you in the morning right back here at 8 o'clock for the conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have yourselves a good evening.